Okay, it's time for us to start, and for the first time in 18 weeks, it's time to look at a different book. It still starts with J. The second letter is still O, but we're looking at the book of Jonah. Jonah is one of the so-called minor prophets. It's called minor prophet because it's short. So it's tucked in between Obadiah, which is 3 pages long, and Micah, which is about 8 or 9 pages long, so you'll have to hunt a little bit. Jonah itself is about 3 pages long in my translation anyway, but there's a lot here.
Obadiah.
Okay. I want to start with the first verse and see if we can finish with this morning.
How long do you think this is going to take us to get through?
Well, I don't know. It depends on how fast we do the first verse.
Maybe a month.
My translation, the word of the Lord was addressed to Jonah, son of Amittai. I learned a long time ago, if you pronounce something as if you know what you're doing, people will believe you do. So, number one, how does the word of the Lord get to people? How does the word of the Lord get to people?
I have the impression that he's directly talking to them, but all the places where he did, I was thinking about that very thing, how God communicated directly, it seems to me.
Scripture said one time of Moses, God speaks to people through dreams and visions, but Moses he spoke to face to face. As if that is unusual for God to speak to people face to face. When God's word comes, how do you know it's God's word? How do you know it's not somebody else's words disguised as God?
You have to test what it says against the scripture.
How do you do that?
I'm not sure how you do it. But my biblical priesthood is that ever going to be true.
Lawyers speak in the hope that the jury would sort of say,
Just like confidence in the pronouncing a word.
That's right. The word of the Lord was addressed to Jonah, son of Amittai. Was it in a letter? With postage? I don't think so. How could it have come? And when it came, how would he know this was a word from the Lord? That turns out to be two huge questions that most of us really ought to be dealing with, and few of us do. He said in a pontifical way.
Can I share an example in my own life?
Sure.
Paul, my son, and his family lived in New England in 2003.
Paul and my son lived in New England in 2003.
Yeah, very good.
2003.
I'm sorry. And we were up there for Christmas, and we were at the Christmas Eve service at their congregational church. And right in the middle of the hymn, I heard this voice, clear as a bell, say, "Take a good look, because you will never see this scene again." And I told Gail that, and she says, "Oh, I think the devil was playing tricks with you." Mm-hmm. Well, as it turned out, and you say, how do you test it? And I don't know how I test that against Scripture. I don't think that's written in here anywhere. But in 2004, I had just gone through prostate cancer surgery, and we were not able to go anywhere. And so our family was split. They were still up in New England. In 2005, Gail had gone. She passed away. Mm-hmm. And so when it said, look at that scene, you'll never see this again. Mm-hmm. I said, well, this had to be God speaking to me. Mm-hmm. Now, I've never heard God's voice as clear as that since then or before then. But I do. It did make me a believer that said God can speak to you directly.
And I've had the same occurrence. Mm-hmm. Seminary. He told me, I want you, in this program. Hmm. I'm looking around, seeing if somebody was behind me.
And no one else heard it. But
no one else heard it. Clear as day, like I'm speaking to you now. Mm-hmm. And I thought to myself, did I hear what I just thought I heard? And he said it again. I want you in this program. Okay, I'll apply.
Can a moment about like that be false?
Sure.
I think so. So it seems to me that it raises that sentence, just that sentence, raises two huge questions. How does a word from God addressed to me get to me? And if something that comes that seems to be a word from God, how do I know for sure? Seems to me one easy thing is ignore it and see what happens. I don't recommend that. But I think that's what some of us might tend to do.
Or you follow it and then you see if things are working out in terms of gates being opened and doors being opened and so forth. Mm-hmm. And make it progress.
You spoke to Gail. You said, I heard this tonight.
Mm-hmm. They didn't hear. I mean, I almost dropped the hymn book.
Hmm. Well, you wouldn't want to do that.
No. Especially in New England.
Might upset tradition. End joke for those of you who haven't been to church yet. What do we know about Jonah, son of Amittai? Answer starts with N. Not much. It isn't nothing. It's not much. Hold the place here and turn to 2 Kings chapter 14. Do not lose your place. We're coming right back. Jonah's a little hard to find. 2 Kings 14. That's right after 2 Kings 13.
Thank you.
And right before. I want to start at verse 13.
14.
Chapter 14, verse 13. 2 Kings, not 1 Kings. 2 Kings, chapter 14, verse 23, I said 13, but I meant 23. In the 15th year of Amaziah, son of Joash, king of Judah, Jeroboam, son of Joash, became king of Israel in Samaria. Joash was pretty active here, wasn't it? No, that's two different Joashes. You sort of learned that. We did this when we went through here. We had Joashes here and there. We had Jeroboams here and there. This was second Jeroboam by the count of some folks. He reigned for 41 years. He did what is displeasing to the Lord and did not give up any of the sins into which Jeroboam, that's Jeroboam the first by some counting, son of Nebat, had led Israel. It was he who recovered the territory of Israel from the pass of Hamath to the sea of the Arabah in accordance with the word which the Lord, the God of Israel, had spoken through who? His servant, Jonah, son of Amittai, comma,
the prophet
from
Gath-Hepher.
Gath. Now, if you pronounce the P and the F, it comes out not sounding like heifer, and somehow having it not sound like heifer is a desirable thing, I think. But it is actually Gath-Hepher would be maybe the way to say it. Gath-Hepher is a village, they say, that's about 8 to 10 miles north of Nazareth. That's where he's from. Okay? And he spoke to Jeroboam. And according to some notes in my Bible, that was around 740 B.C., something like that, maybe 750 B.C., was maybe when that happened. Are we okay so far? on the board, I have the first half of a list of prophets that I put together for you some time ago. And I show you that Jonah is listed over here on this side. Is there now reason to challenge that? Are any of you thinking about the facts that have been set before you?
Well, he was
Israel's king.
He came
from the north.
From north of Nazareth. Nazareth is in the northern part. That means Nazareth was in the northern kingdom, right?
Which is Israel.
Which is Israel. But I have him listed on the right hand side.
But he did his work in Judah.
Isn't that odd? Have I made a mistake? God forbid. Well, here is what tradition. That's an in joke for the people who have attended the 85 service. This is what tradition says about Jonah. They say that they think he's a young man who was raised from the dead by Elijah. Don't know if that's true. Don't know if that's true or not. They also think he may have been a refugee when the northern kingdom was invaded 3 or 4 or 5 times by Assyria before finally falling in 721 B.C. He may have been a refugee who had moved to the southern kingdom, because tradition places him most of his life in the southern kingdom. But where'd he come from? He came from somewhere up north of Nazareth. So, tradition. I've done that enough. Those of you who haven't been to the service yet, you'll know why I did that a little bit later. But there's stories of this that talk about this. There's the story about Elijah is in 2 Kings 17. I don't think you need to look that up right now, but if you want to look, there's some stories that have emerged, non-biblical, but you know, the things that sort of go along, the rabbinical stories that came down, that suggest maybe that he was that person. If he was indeed a refugee from the northern kingdom coming down to the southern kingdom as Assyria comes in to attack 2 or 3 times, what do you think his attitude about Assyria might be? It might not be positive. What was your assignment for this week?
Read Jonah.
Read Jonah. How much of Jonah? Every bit. That includes verse 2. We're not to verse 2 yet. We're still in verse 1. But Jesus mentioned Jonah's story. If you've read all of Jonah, you know his story now. Or if you've read it in the past, you know his story. Jesus mentioned that in a very critical moment. Somebody said, give us a sign that shows that you really are the Messiah. And Jesus says, the only sign you're going to get is the sign of Jonah. You want to take a guess what scholars think Jesus was talking about?
3 days in
the... He's dead for 3 days and resurrected. Jonah is in the belly of the fish 3 days, and he comes back on the shore. Okay. Jesus said, that's the only sign you're going to get. Now, I'm puzzled by that, because it seems like to me Jesus gave lots and lots of other signs. If you look at what Jesus said, he's suggesting that's the one that matters. And there are religions around the world that honor Jesus as a wise man, honor Jesus as a great teacher. But it comes to the point of dying on the cross? I don't think so. And Jesus said, that's the one that matters. So Jonah becomes a pivotal person just because of that. And then there's these hints of some special nature for him that go along. Now, that was verse 1. Verse 2. Let's go back and read verse 1 so we can roll into verse 2 with a little bit of momentum. The word of the Lord was addressed to Jonah, son of Amittai. Get up, he said. Make a short list of what God said for Jonah to do. What's the first thing?
Get up.
Get up. What's the implication? He's not up yet. What's the second thing? Go to Nineveh, that great city. Does your translation say
yes.
That great city? Because much of the time when Nineveh is mentioned and God is speaking, he says, that great city. Get up, he said. Go to Nineveh, that great city. That's number two. What's number three? Some translations say preach to them. My translation says proclaim to them. Your translation says
cry
against them. Okay? This translation, New Living, says announce my judgment against it. And then the rest of verse 2 tells you why he wants Jonah to say those things. Why does he want Jonah to say? This translation says, proclaim to them that their wickedness has forced itself upon me. I think that's the least helpful of the translations I've seen, but there it is. Here's New Living. Announce my judgment against it because I have seen how wicked its people are. What does yours say?
Has come before me.
Their wickedness, their evil deeds have come before me. Have come to my attention. Oh, that's really good. Have come up to me. Okay? The one that I find the most interesting is the Message. Eugene Peterson has written a paraphrase. Some of you know about it. It's called The Message. On my particular electronic tablet, I'm able to put New Living on one side and The Message on the other side. Listen to The Message at that point. Up on your feet and on your way to the big city of Nineveh. Preach to them. They're in a bad way, and I can't ignore it any longer. Do you hear the difference? Is he right? I don't know. But Eugene Peterson has put a very, very interesting turn on that phrase. They are in a bad way, and I can't ignore it any longer. What does it mean for someone to say of someone else, they're in a bad way? And I can't ignore it anymore. They need help. And I don't know if that's right, but I'll tell you, Eugene Peterson has looked at things pretty interestingly, and sometimes he comes out with phrases that make me think. The other translations all sound like what? Hit them with a hammer. I'm done with them. But this one translation says, they are in such trouble unless I intervene, they're lost forever. Can we pause for just a minute? Short time out. What is likely to be Jonah's attitude towards Assyria? They're in trouble? Excellent. I've been praying for something like that. I thought you should have done this 15 years ago, 20 years ago. Why'd you take so long? Yeah. And I have a sneaky suspicion hate might have been the attitude. I don't know that that's particularly reflective of God's image inside of us, but I suspect that's a human response he might have had. Get up, he said. I'd like you to pay attention to that little phrase, because it's going to show up a few more places, and if you're not careful, you won't notice when it hits you again. Get up, he said. Do you know the phrase, stuck in the mud?
Yes.
What does it imply? You're not going anywhere. I almost hear that in this comment. 2 Kings suggests that maybe God's been using this guy for some things. But it also, this phrase suggests maybe he's in a rut, and God is saying, now I need you to do something else. Get up. Turn. Move. Verse 3. My first word is but. Not all translations have that. This translation, for example, doesn't. But it's kind of nice if it does. What was God's orders? Get up, go to Nineveh, preach to them, and here's why. Now, I want to do a little orienting. Where was Jonah at this point? Probably. Your clue is on the board. Probably in the southern kingdom, probably somewhere around Jerusalem, probably somewhere there. Where's Nineveh?
That's what I was going to ask you.
Where's Nineveh? Well, let me give you a little bit of additional information. For close to 1,500 years, most people thought Nineveh had never existed. The first evidence that Nineveh existed was in excavations in the 1820s or 1830s or 1840s by some British explorers. And once they started excavating, the ruins that they found were immense. Huge. I've seen two different estimates. I don't know which one to believe. One estimate said they unearthed a city wall that was 7 miles in circumference. Another estimate said they unearthed one that was 80 miles in circumference. That's a big difference, and I don't know which one to believe. There's one translation, one report that I read that suggested that chariots could go on top of the wall to run equipment and resupplies and things like that to the people who might be repelling invaders. Okay, it was lost. There were two mounds across the river from Mosul in northern Iraq. Mosul has been in the news lately. Across the river from Mosul, there were two big mounds. One has a more or less unpronounceable name. The second one, if you look at it carefully, it may not be much easier to pronounce, but if you look carefully, you start to realize, and when you hear the translation, it's right, it's called the Prophet Jonah Mound. And it's been called that for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, and nobody knew why. In their excavation, they've excavated a place that they think is the tomb of Jonah. But there's also claimed to be a tomb of Jonah somewhere in a little village about 8 miles north of Nazareth. There's also supposed to be a tomb for Jonah somewhere in Jerusalem. All these are sort of revered spots. They can't all be right, but these are places where pilgrims might go. And on July the 24th of last year, the forces of ISIS blew up the supposed monument tomb of Jonah in the ruins of Nineveh. Because they said we don't want those things in our new world order. Cross the river, cross the Tigris, from Mosul, northern Iraq, the part where the ISIS forces now are largely in control. And they're starting to blow up things that might remind you of stories like this. So, from Jerusalem, if the Mediterranean Sea was kind of like this, and my artistic abilities are poor, and my knowledge is even poorer, the Mediterranean Sea is maybe like that, with Jerusalem down here, the Sea of Galilee up here, the Dead Sea down here someplace. Nazareth would have been somewhere up there. I don't know how close to this. I don't know what the dimensions are. And Nineveh is way over here on the Tigris River. So, God's orders are, go to Nineveh.
Where
does
it go?
Which means he has to cross the Euphrates.
Where does Jonah go?
Tarshish.
He goes
the wrong place. Huh?
He goes to Tarshish.
Joppa, which is, I think, modern Haifa. Mm-hmm. And he gets on a ship headed for Tarshish. Now, I don't know for sure, but I'm told by the commentators that that means Spain. That's about as far as you can go that way. And God said, go this way. What's Jonah saying by his actions? I don't want to go there. I do not want to go that way. And I'm going to make sure that I don't accidentally go that way by going this other way. There is a person at the University of Richmond that I met about a week ago. This is a person who is in our religion department, which is not the same as a department of Christianity. This person is an expert on the Bible, and especially the New Testament. And I heard her say, one of the most fascinating things I've been studying lately is how much it would have cost for Paul to make the travels he made in his missionary journeys. He had to have immense wealth because it was very, very costly to travel. That's an interesting thought.
I never thought about that.
This guy gets up, heads to Joppa, hops on the next ship out, heading somewhere that way, and it happens to be going to Spain, Tarshish. Great! That takes me about as far away as I can get. But somehow he had the dinero, he had the money, he had the cost of the ticket. And I'm not sure what that means, but I just flagged that as we moved by. How are we doing so far? We've made it all the way to the first half. No, I guess we've made it all the way through verse 3. One translation said he paid the fare and went on board. One translation said he bought a ticket and went on board, hoping to escape from the Lord by sailing to Tarshish. How'd that sailing trip go? Not so good. Verse 4 starts with the word but. But the Lord hurled, this is the first translation, a powerful wind over the sea, causing a violent storm that threatened to sink the ship. Is that what it says? That's not what mine says. Mine does not say threatened to sink the ship. Threatened to break it up into little bitty pieces, which would then sink. Okay? Fearing for their lives, the desperate sailors shouted to their gods for help and threw the cargo overboard to lighten the ship. How do you make money off of a sailing voyage in those days? You carry cargo from here, you purchase it here, you sell it there, and when you sell it, you hope to make a profit that helps to pay for the journey. What did they just do? They threw the cargo overboard. They're going to end up broke and in debt by the time they get through. That's the act of total desperation. Here's how the Message reads it. But God sent a huge storm at sea, the waves towering. The ship was about to break into pieces. The sailors were terrified. They called out in desperation, and they threw everything they were carrying overboard to lighten the ship. And then that verse, which I think is verse 5, ends with a fascinating sentence. What does it say?
Jonah.
Tells you where Jonah was. He had gone down into the hold, mine says. What does yours say? In the inner part of the ship, mine just says into the hold. And what was happening? Mine does not say asleep. Mine says fast asleep. Yours says deep in sleep. Deep sleep.
So how can you do that when everybody else is terrified?
That's my
God point. Did it. I
the people are not just terrified. What's happening to the ship?
It's
threatening to break apart. What's happening to the ship?
It's
being tossed up and at angles of all sorts. Right? And where's Jonah?
Asleep.
Not just asleep. Fast asleep, deep in sleep. That's the question.
And everybody else is throwing up.
Or screaming in terror. Or lifting this. Now, where do you get the cargo from? They're throwing the cargo overboard. Where was the cargo before they threw it overboard? Down the hold. They probably had to push Jonah out of the way to take some of the stuff out. And where was Jonah? What was he doing?
Fast
asleep. Deep asleep. My question is, it's still hanging out here. How can that be? There is, it seems to me, one explanation with three possible parts. Did that obscure it enough for you?
Right. Yes.
Yep.
Why would he be fast asleep, deep in sleep, in the middle of the worst storm? These are almost certainly experienced sailors. They are in terror. They are doing something unthinkable. At all costs, save as much of the cargo as you can. At least you got a chance to come out even and start over again. They're throwing everything they can find overboard. This is the worst storm they've ever seen. And where's Jonah? Fast asleep, down the hole. Did you notice who went down to see him?
Captain.
Yeah. Why? Because I think the crew has already been there. As they move this box, they kick Jonah. As they move this box, they drop it on his foot.
Why did they do that?
If you were the crew, wouldn't you do that?
I can
hear him say, "Why aren't you helping?" And off they went. When the captain comes down, I think that's a signal that the others have already been there. I don't know that for sure, but I think so. What could have somebody that deeply asleep?
You have to keep in mind, too, little small ships.
Ship's not all that big. We might ought to call it a boat. I've been toying with the idea. Do I call it a ship this morning, or do I call it a boat? Or do I call it Leaky as a nickname? What could make him sleep like this?
Well, it could have been that he knew that God had communicated him at first in a dream, and so God caused him to sleep so he could communicate with him again.
Maybe. Hadn't thought of that one.
Or he could figure that he was already doomed because he had directly disobeyed God's command.
Yeah. The implication is he's unaware of all this stuff happening. It's quite possible he was completely aware of what was happening and said, "Well, whatever happens now, I deserve it.
I've done more,
and why not?" My sense is that the best explanation might be that he is exhausted. How many different ways can you be exhausted?
Emotionally.
Physically. Mentally. At least those three. I think spiritual is hanging out there somewhere, sort of overarching the other three. And I think that's what had happened. He was totally exhausted. But I think it's a very interesting possibility that as he saw all this coming, he says, "Okay, that's it.
Let's get satisfied right now."
It takes courage for someone who knows God as well as Jonah appears to know God to deliberately disobey God. God says go this way. He doesn't just stay home. God said go this way. I forget what's on the board behind me. He's deliberately going the other way. And I think once he did that, he may have said, "Well." In any event, this translation said the Lord threw a hurricane at the sea. Such a great storm. Yes. Yes, ma'am?
No, I just said great.
Oh, okay. Jonah had, however, gone below and laid down in the hold and was fast asleep. When the captain went up to him, this one says the boatswain, and I don't know how to pronounce that. They have these nautical terms that get pronounced differently than you would think. Went up to him and said, "What do you mean by sleeping?" What's the next word?
Arise.
Get up. What did I tell you to do a little while ago? Keep your eye on that little get up. Get up, he says.
Call on your
God. Maybe he will. Now, right there is a phrase or word that I want to make sure we see all the different possibilities that we have in the translations. Mine says, perhaps he will spare us a thought and thus not leave us to die.
Take notice
of us.
Give a thought to us.
So that we
consider
us.
Have mercy on us.
The ones that imply it's possible God hasn't noticed the plight we're in. So call on him to get his attention.
Would be concerned about us.
What would Jonah's response to that have likely been, were he to have had time to do this? Remember, the noise is probably deafening. The boat is still probably pitching and yawing, whatever other words they use for this. Pitching and yawing, I think, is an aeronautic, not a nautical term. call on your God. All of us have been calling on our gods, and nothing's happening. You call on your God. Perhaps he will spare us a thought, notice us, take note of us, have mercy on us, and not leave us to die. I like verse 7. Mine says, then they said to him. Now the captain has already spoken. This is they. Who's they? I think it's the crew. And I think the crew steps in and says, wait a minute, I know how to do this. Let's cast lots and figure out who's to blame for the situation we're in. Now, how do you cast lots, which I presume means you throw dice or chicken bones or whatever you do. You do something that reveals something, right? There is one tradition that says they did this three times just to make sure they got it right. And all three times it pointed to Jonah. This time it simply says, come on, let's draw lots, this one says. Cast lots, another translation says, to find out who is to blame for bringing us this bad luck. So they cast lots. Drew lots, cast lots. And the lot pointed to Jonah. And immediately the questions come. What's the big word in the first question? Well, I don't know the order that it shows them in yours. The order jumps around a little bit. One of them is, who are you? Why are you here? Where do you live? What is your nationality? And maybe in the spirit of Alberto this morning, maybe there's somebody who's not living where they used to live and they're a citizen now of another place. Where do you live? And what is your ethnicity? What's your nationality? So you've got a who, what, where, why kind of barrage that's coming at them. And what does Jonah say in response? And please don't think that everything is quiet as Jonah speaks, because I think the boat is still doing this kind of thing. I think the wind is still howling. I think all this stuff is still going on. I think he's yelling into a gale, and I think he would be hard to hear. What does Jonah say?
I am
Hebrew. I worship the Lord, the God of heaven who made both sea and dry land. And the sailors were seized with terror at this. And they said, why did you do this? Since they knew he was trying to escape from the Lord because he had told them. Woo. When did he tell them? Starts with W. We don't know. Maybe right then. Maybe he took time enough to say another sentence or two. Maybe he had said it as he came on board the ship.
My translation says, how could you do this?
Right.
Why ever did you do this? They grilled him, the message says, confess. Why this disaster? What is your work? Where do you come from? What country? What family? Verse 10. Upon his words, all the men were frightened, really frightened, and they said, what on earth have you done? I think that's the best translation I've seen of that little sentence. What on earth have you done?
Bill, do you think that those questions that they are asking him because when these people, like, it happened fast, even civilizations that don't know God, care about God. So they ask him, because what are these questions relevant to them right now?
It would have been hundreds and hundreds of years before that God brought a nation of slaves out of Egypt. One suspects knowledge of that would have been kicking around. And some of the other things that had happened, that would have been kicking around.
And think about when Jesus got in the boat on the Sea of Galilee and went to sleep.
Yeah, I decided not to bring that up, but I did think about that. I don't know how to fit that in a way that's productive, because I think the situation for Jonah and Jesus are about as different as they could possibly be, but there is certainly a parallel with that. Verse 11, they said to him, what are we going to do with you to get rid of this storm? Because by this time, the storm was totally out of control. And Jonah said, throw me overboard.
Take me up.
Into the sea. If you do that, the storm will stop. It's all my fault. I'm the cause of the storm. Get rid of me. You'll get rid of the storm. And the people said, good idea. And they threw him overboard, right? Right? No. What did they do? They rowed as hard. Now, I don't know if this boat was equipped with oars or if they had to put out boats that were equipped with oars to tug it this way, to tug it that way. I suspect the oars were in the boat. These men would not do what Jonah said. They tried their best to spare him. In the end, they were unsuccessful. They made no headway. They were trying to row back to shore. I'm wondering how far out of the harbor they had gotten. I'm not sure they got more than a mile or two. So finally, they prayed to God. Oh God, don't let us drown because of this man's life, and don't blame us for his death. You are God. You do what they think, what you think is best. And they took Jonah and they threw him overboard. And what happened? Immediately, everything was still. Where's Jonah? They don't know because he's gone.
It's funny, don't you think, that they prayed to his God?
It's interesting, absolutely. The sailors were impressed, no longer terrified by the sea, but in awe of God. And they made sacrifices, they worshipped, and they made vows to serve him, one translation says. Meanwhile, what's happened to Jonah? My translation, last verse, God had arranged, I love that word in one translation, God had arranged for a great fish to swallow Jonah. And he was in the belly of the fish for 3 days and three nights. I remember when we were living in Gainesville, we read about scuba divers in off the shore of Tampa swimming alongside of a grouper that they said was about the size of a Buick station wagon. And the grouper turned and went, and one of the guys disappeared with all of his gear. I can't find a newspaper article to prove that, but I saw a newspaper article at the time. A moment or two later, he burps and spits the guy out without his scuba gear. And they buddy breathe him back up to the surface. Was that what happened? What do you do? I've trained you. Maybe. I don't know. There's been all kinds of speculation about what this was. There's all kinds of speculation about what this was. You just go speculate away. But in any event, that's where we're going to leave him until the next time we're together. What's your assignment? Read the rest of Jonah, starting with chapter 2. Let's have a word of prayer. Our Father, the most dangerous place to be is someplace you've told us you want us to go someplace else. Hiding in this story, at the very least, is that thought. If you do speak to us, and we hope you will, and if we do realize it's from you, and I hope we will be able to discern whether a word has come from you or not, then the safest thing that we can possibly do is to obey. At whatever price, at whatever peril, no other option is anywhere near as good as that one. So we ask that you, with your Spirit, would teach us, that you would speak to us. We suspect you're speaking to us, and we just haven't figured out how to hear you. So I pray that we could have ears to hear. And I pray all this in the name of your Son. Amen.